Then they talk about the global village and the market forces. Others they dream of prosperity. With big fat beggars riding happy horses. Then they search for big, big drugs to take to cure diseases caused by small, small bugs. And they study the sparrow so as to learn more bits and ways to take to design them. Arrow. Build a bridge across from me to you. All I wanna do. Now to feel this space, brothers and sisters, feel this space between me and you.
I got to let you know.
You are beautiful, Lord.
Welcome to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever across the globe you may be, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly from Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, by Amnesty International volunteers Jim Hutchings and Mona Hill, who are part of a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're working to build a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. And welcome to our guests today. We're very happy to have in our presence Florence Stratton and Shannon Corkery, who are members of the Regina Making Peace Vigil. This will be a fascinating hour as we share stories and strategies about the vigil and the people who dedicate themselves to education and activism. Welcome, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. I'm here, too.
Welcome, Mona.
Thank you. And welcome back, everyone. For those of you who have been listening religiously to our show, you know, people go on holidays, and I just thought I'd let you know that the reason you've been hearing some previous shows is because people are away, and they like to have some time off, so we thought it would be interesting to play a few shows from our past to refresh you about what we do here. And today we have our live guests, Shannon and Florence, and we're going to talk again. We had them on the show probably over a year ago.
I think it was two years already.
Wow. And you'll note that a few times in the past in on our shows, I've mentioned the Regina Making Peace Vigil and the wonderful relationship that we have with the members, and passing information back and forth and supporting one another in our quest for sort of a social, what's the word I'm looking for, Florence, here, help me, social activism, yeah, and people, information about people who would be good to interview on the show. Activities are occurring in Regina and Saskatchewan that are coming up in the future, and so I thought maybe I'd let them come on the show, have a show with them. Actually, I beg Florence, please come on the show, and talk about the vigil again to inform people, because it's, I believe, has become a very important part of the fabric of our city of Regina here. And they're out there every Thursday afternoon, come rain or shine, or blizzard or drought, out on Scar Street, passing out information about the latest concerns that they have. It's not just about making peace, but it's about a lot of other things. So maybe I'll pass it over to Florence and let you give us a little bit of a background on the Making Peace Vigil.
Well, we held our first vigil on May 3rd, 2007. So we're into our fifth year and haven't missed a week yet. We sometimes take shelter in adjoining buildings when it's too cold out there and warm up for a few minutes. But anyways, we've been out there. Every week we pass out between 100 and 200 flyers. I don't think we've been below 100 for quite a while. We pass them out to noontime shoppers and downtown Regina workers. And, yeah, somewhere between 100 and 200 people take them from us. We have a cover range of issues, as Mona said. Certainly peace. We've been looking at Afghanistan and Libya. For flyers, it seems endlessly, particularly with Afghanistan, but we've had to look at Libya two or three times already. Issues of justice, First Nations education, for example, how the government is underfunding it. Water issues, uranium issues, tar sands, pesticide use, bottled water. Shannon's mother did a flyer for us on bottled water. Palestine and Israel, Buy Nothing Day, we have a flyer on that. So there are endless issues, unfortunately.
Absolutely. We recently did one on prisons and the federal government's plan to pass a new bill that's going to include some legislation that will result in more people in being in jail, especially in Saskatchewan.
Why especially in Saskatchewan?
Because Saskatchewan has a really high youth incarceration rate, and also related to issues of racism, there's more surveillance of young Aboriginal people in Saskatchewan. So, and also in relation to who is viewed as a potential criminal is largely related to racism, especially in Saskatchewan.
So. And we're talking about stereotyping here, profiling.
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay. And Shannon, how did you get involved with the Peace Vigil?
So I used to go back to the Regina Insight Meditation Community, and I was part of it. When I was 19, I started going with my dad to this meditation group, and from the group they had an offshoot of people who said that, okay, now we want to be more conscious and aware, but we also feel like we need to act. And I think it's really easy for myself as someone kind of in a middle-class position to be, okay, I'm going to be everything is all one, or kind of have a spiritual mentality, but then to be complacent and complicit with everyday actions where maybe I benefit from the dominant culture. And so to actually take action isn't something that I was originally doing and that I felt was important. And then from that group, the Women in Black group came out of that, which was a group before the Peace Vigil. So it's all kind of this connecting thread.
Okay.
And for me, that was really important because the whole process of being aware of my thoughts and not just saying, okay, every thought that I have is who I am, but having a little bit of distance, I was able to start to see racist thoughts that I had, thoughts of superiority that I had, like how I was socialized by the dominant culture and how in interactions with everyday people that this is part of me that I previously hadn't seen before. And it's a lifelong process because I thought I was doing pretty good with it, but recently I took a class and it really opened to my eyes to what's going on. And but for some reason, injustice gets so normalized, and racism and what even we think race means and how it's been socially constructed, it just gets so normalized. And that I feel like I'm part of it, even as someone who wants to do justice or be an activist or work for change, that I can't see myself separate from it. And also, I've been really interested, too, in the whole helping mentality of, okay, and a lot of my teachers talked about this summer, which was really awesome, about the idea of, being a good white activist and kind of getting a little bit of a power trip from that. But if I think about it, the people that I want to work for change and be allies with are people that I've benefited at the expense of their oppression. And so to really put that into perspective for me has been opening my eyes. So But yeah, so I think that, and so in terms of the vigil, I don't get out there every day. I'm not as committed as some of the members who I really respect, but I feel like it's really important to say that things are not okay as they are. And there's other stuff going on that it's easy for some people, including myself, if we want to avoid it, and it, because it doesn't affect my day-to-day life right now, but there are a lot of people that it affects their day-to-day life every day. But I also feel like it is going to be, all of these issues that we're talking about do affect all of us in other ways, and in the future, I think we're all going to be affected by a lot of issues.
So what I'm hearing is you're saying that being part of the vigil enables you to take part in a form of activism that maybe you couldn't do before. This is one way, one avenue to be able to do that and to be able to speak out about the things that are important to you and the things that you've learned about through your classes in school and through your everyday interactions with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if this is quite what Shannon was saying, but being involved in the vigil is so self-educating, and you do learn about your own racism. Who knows how many people read those flyers that they take? But what I do know is that we are much better educated about not only the racism in the society, but our own racist thoughts. Because it's very, I mean, you have to keep struggling against them. The society is so, it's saturated with them.
Right, yeah. Right. It's totally systemic, and we internalize that as we grow. And
you have to keep struggling against it all the time.
Right. Yeah. I know as a social worker, one of the things that was constantly discussed in the classes that I went to when I was back in school was examining your own value systems, examining your own beliefs, and trying to figure out where did that come from so that you can effectively work with anyone that you come across in the course of your career. So that's something that is like sort of secondhand for me to be able to think about that. But not everybody has that option or that opportunity to actually think about that kind of stuff. So, and I imagine that a lot of that comes from the research that is done to do the flyers, to make them up. It's kind of like being in school and having to do a research paper, right? And then, but the thing is about the brochures, for those of you who've never had one, you know, they're not like 5 or 6 page brochures or little booklets where there's a lot of information. So the information in the brochures is very, very concise and extremely well put together with as many facts that are as pertinent, you know, as they can possibly be. There's a wealth, an absolute wealth of information about each topic that the vigil chooses to disseminate each week to the public. For instance, maybe give us an example, Florence, of a recent brochure that you've passed out.
Well, maybe I could mention one that we are going to pass out on September the 1st.
Okay, right.
Moving
on
into the future, we're going to be handing out a flyer on the minimum wage. And on September 1st, the minimum wage is going up by a whole 25 cents.
Woo.
Woo.
Let's party.
From $9.25 to $9.50. Now, here's some shocking figures that I dug up. In 2010, the CEO of Potash Corporation earned over $11 million. Well, a full-time minimum wage worker earned just over $19,000. And I guess this leads to the question, how much inequality is too much inequality?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think any inequality is wrong, but this is really too much inequality.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and okay, I'll play devil's advocate. What about the people who say, but wait a minute, the CEO of Potash Corporation has immense responsibilities, whereas a minimum wage worker goes to their job, works for 8 hours, goes home with their family. They don't need to make any more money.
You know what? I was thinking about this argument the other day, and I recently met a single mother who works two minimum wage jobs, and just taking care of her family and all of the other stuff that comes with that. And I would say she has way more stress than a CEO. So, like, that whole argument about meritocracy, like, when you look at people's lives and the stress that it's caused for a place to live, especially if there's racism involved and you can't find a place and you're facing racism at work or can't find a job. I can't speak to this because I've never experienced it, but just from listening to other people, it's like, I can't, that argument is really sounding more weak to me these days.
Okay. All right. What other facts do you have about minimum wage, Florence?
Let me see. Let me get out that. Do you have that flyer there? Well, maybe while I'm digging it out, where did I put it?
Oh, or we could go on to something else, and we could come back to that one after
right.
the break. Sure.
Yeah.
I see you've got quite a few there. That's
right.
Great. Yeah. I'm looking at that Remembering Hiroshima one.
Yes, a couple of weeks ago, well, on the anniversary, a few days before the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, we had a flyer remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we talk about Canada's involvement in the nuclear weapons industry, how from 1942 to 1969, we started trading atoms with the U.S. and Britain and so on. And then from 1970, from 1970 to up to the present, Canada has been exporting reactors and the material for atomic weapons as a result. And then after that, we've been exporting raw uranium, which is made into weapons of mass destruction in terms of depleted uranium weaponry. Even though Canada signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in the 1970s, it has been involved in, you know, trading atoms in one way or another up until the present.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
With us on that occasion, we were joined by the Singers of the Sacred Web. I don't know if you've ever interviewed them.
We never have had the opportunity to interview them, so tell us a little bit about them.
Right. Well, they are a local branch of an international organization. I'm trying to remember some of this. They're a singing group, and they're about to do a recording in Banff, a new CD, which will be out very shortly. But they base the songs that they perform on, on the Earth Charter, I believe. So all of the songs that they perform and record are based on the Earth Charter.
Mm-hmm.
But they also perform the Elm Dance, which Healing the World is what it's called, and it's an intimate folk song which has grown into the Elm Dance. It's danced by circles of activists around the world, from somewhere near Chernobyl to the uranium mines in northern Saskatchewan. This dance has been performed. It's danced with reverence for human and more than human life, and in solidarity with trees who breathe in and who breathe in what we breathe out. The dance always begins with the dancers stating together a statement of intention. We do this dance as a way of strengthening our intention to participate in the healing of this beloved planet, its humans, and all beings. So they performed, and we joined in with them, the Elm Dance on the Scar Street Mall. So
wow. Was there a good response to that from the public?
Well, people they looked.
My question about this particular flyer relates to young people.
Mm-hmm.
You and I and Jim have more memory, I believe, of an education behind us about the end of World War II and about the bombs dropping and about the disasters that occurred due to that and the reasons for everything. And so when we remember it, we have a certain remembrance that a lot of young people nowadays don't have. And in fact, in my own family in the past, I had someone in my family who was from the southern United States for a while as an in-law who, when we talked about this back in the early 1980s with him about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the bombs, he didn't believe us. He had no knowledge of this. He had not been taught when he was in school that this had occurred. In fact, his response was, well, my country would never do that to anyone. So I guess I'm asking in context with that is, what kind of response did you get or do you get from people in bringing this issue to the forefront in public? Is there anybody that talks to you about it or says, I've never even heard of this before or, you know, what, just sort of your basic response to this?
Well, to me, that brings up a kind of a deeper issue of when we are presenting information, and even in my own experience, of when we're learning information that challenges kind of like a dominant storyline or it's kind of like this identity I have of myself as a Canadian, and we're learning information and be like, oh, my country wouldn't do that or we wouldn't do that, that there is a lot of opposition. And even like in my own process, I feel like... there's two levels of absorbing information, and I wonder with that on the vigil if people hang on to their flyers and maybe a little while later they can absorb it more of it. But obviously we take things in intellectually, and but I think on that, purely on that level, in my experience, it's easy just to kind of slough it off or somehow. I think we're really good in our culture of... justifying things or legitimizing injustice because there's some sort of excuse that we can use. But when we can actually like understand on a more embodied level, or everyone has their own process of understanding information, but on a deeper level, I think that's when we change, like when there's the motivation or the inspiration or the passion to want to make change and be part of it happens. So with the vigil, I think that we're starting on the education level, but I also feel like someone mentioned this to me this summer, and he mentioned that he appreciated the vigil because it was a space that was acknowledging things that aren't always acknowledged. And I think just in those, when I was there for the prisons flyer, just like having interactions with people about issues, even if we didn't necessarily agree on the issue, but we're talking about it. Like, it's not just hidden.
Right.
So I think there is a lot of opposition, and I've seen that in myself. But I feel like, yeah, I really agree with that. It's important to have these spaces.
So what I'm getting is one of the benefits of having the vigil is just bringing things out into the public and having it discussed, because eventually you hope for that, that change of heart or that understanding.
Or whatever that process is.
Yeah, yeah. And then the action, the action that goes along with it, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is what you're attempting to do just by being there, is taking action.
Well, if people don't know, how are they going to act?
Yeah.
That's so. Education is the first step, obviously.
And the space between education and action is something I've been thinking a lot about, too, because often people, there's a lot of different controversy on, okay, we need to act now, or other people are like, no, we need to be patient and do things, you know. So there's a lot of different thoughts on that. And from my experience, I do feel like something like the vigil is an action that I... that because when you're making the flyer, you have to go through the reflection period, and it's a process. I've only been part of making one, but just during that one, I realized what a big process that is. And but also the space, as much as I think there's an emphasis on action, but I think on the space to feel uncomfortable about what's going on. Because often I think in the past that my action for social justice and action or activism that I was part of was motivated by not wanting to separate myself from the dominant culture or wanting to somehow redeem myself or come from a place of not wanting to feel whatever I was feeling.
And maybe that's the key word, is motivation. When we do become activists, when we make that decision to take action of any kind, what is our motivation behind that? I think that's sort of the the there's going to be the everlasting concept of why am I really doing this? Am I making a difference? And what does it mean for me personally? What am I getting out of it? And are we ever going to be able to say, I'm going to do this regardless of what I get out of it? Only maybe because we might decide it's the right thing to do. Or I'm not being appreciated, so I'm not doing this anymore, right? Motivation is a key word, I think, in this.
And how to be an ally. I'm starting to learn a little bit more about that. Yeah, what that means.
Yeah, and advocating with rather than for.
Yeah, it's very humbling experience.
It's a whole learning experience.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, we've got a couple of minutes left, 2 minutes left before the break. What kind of results do you expect to get other than just bringing up conversation or what kind of results just... sort of quickly, or what results have you had in the past that has continued to keep you going out there in the middle of blizzards and rainstorms? And obviously, you're getting something
Are
is happening.
Revolution floors,
right? Change the world, of course.
Florence is very soft spoken, but I think she's got the heart of a lion.
Well, we obviously don't think we're going to change the world, but. I mean, if you don't have any public activism, there isn't going to be any political transformation, political and social
there
transformation.
It is. Okay.
Yeah. So you can hope. I mean, certainly we get, I mean, in terms of what we get ourselves, we get community and friendship out of it. It's an expression also, I guess, of one's outrage at injustice. It's an outlet for that outrage.
So are you out there yelling at people in outrage?
No. The flyer is the outrage. Okay. We are, by and large, smiling sweetly.
As my mother used to say, you get more bees with honey than you do with vinegar. I think we'll take a break now, and we'll come back after the break and continue this conversation. Okay.
And I've got a nice song about plutonium coming out of the break. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
I want to tell you about a brand new product on the market. It's man-made, not a gift from the gods. You can't buy it from Sears, but the nuclear power plants have it in their spent fuel rods. The only thing it can do is kill all forms of life for many thousands of years to come. So on behalf of the future generations of the world, I don't think I'll have me some plutonium. Tell me now, what can you do with the stuff? You can't drown it in water or burn it in stuff. You could pack it in a rocket ship and send it off to space, but just like good old Skylab, it'll come back in our face. Plutonium, a pound in pieces the size of pollen, spread around the world's enough to do us all in. A millionth of a gram in our bodies today will cause cancer 15, 20 years along the way. Plutonium, and it takes 25,000 years before half of its deadly power disappears. And each reactor makes 500 pounds a year. That's an awful lot of deadly stuff for hanging around here. It's just like having a pile of high explosive bombs sitting in your own backyard. With these nuclear plants all over the land, to blow us all away wouldn't be hard. Our enemies wouldn't need any fancy kind of weapons to do the damage of which I speak. Just attack those nukes any way that they can, and we'll all be glowing in a week. Plutonium, tell me now, what can you do with the stuff? You can't drown it in water or burn it, it's tough. You could pack it in a rocket ship and send it off to space, but just like good old Skylab, it'll come back in our face. Plutonium, the government says those nukes are safe and clean, 'cause they gotta make fuel for their war machine. And when folks claim we don't need nuclear power today, they say, shut up or we're gonna take your toasters away. Plutonium, it only takes a tiny little sliver to cause cancer in your lungs, bones, your blood, or your liver. And
and it gets in the food chain to accumulate. Well, it won't be too much longer and we're already eight. Radiation really gets to little children and babies. It's the saddest tale to tell, 'cause it damages the DNA and cancer forms quickest in a rapidly dividing cell. Oh, the dangers have been known from the first split atom. Yes, those scientists, they knew it well. That's why plutonium is named after the Greek god Pluto, the god of death and hell. Plutonium, tell me now, what can you do with the stuff? You can't drown it in water or burn it in stuff. You can pack it in a rocket ship and send it off to space, but just like good old Skylab, it'll come back in our face. Plutonium, we're messing with something we're not supposed to. It's an awful crazy way just to power a toaster. We can meet all our needs with the wind and the sun, and a little conservation never hurt anyone. Plutonium, if you think the whole darn thing is crazy, you better get up off your seats now and don't be lazy. Spread the word to your friends and neighbors around the town. Hey, let's get together, people, shut them killer plants down.
Oh, yeah, shut those killer plants down. That's a gentleman by the name of Stephen J. Goodman. And plutonium is what is in the spent fuel rods that is proposed to be sent off to northern Saskatchewan or wherever. I mean, that's one of the proposed places, so that's why I thought I would play that little ditty. And it's quite a bit of education there about plutonium, isn't there?
Absolutely. Holy cow.
It's nasty, nasty
yeah,
stuff.
It's like yeah. I said, it's a whole science class in one song.
Yeah.
And yeah, Jim mentioned that Nuclear Waste Management Organization is looking for a place to store nuclear waste and that the rods that contain plutonium. I even mentioned that one time I did a Google on cigarettes to find out what the ingredients were in cigarettes. And for those of you who don't know this, there is a form of plutonium that is in cigarettes. There are so many chemicals that are harmful to us. It just absolutely blew me away. So if you know, thinking that just because you've been alive for a long time, and even though you're a smoker, maybe just check it out and find out what's in the cigarettes you're smoking, because there is plutonium in it. And speaking of nuclear waste storage, I just sort of want to catch up with those of you who have been listening to our shows in the past and have been aware of the walk for 7,000 generations from Pine House, Saskatchewan to Regina. It's approximately 900 kilometer walk that a number of people took, indigenous populations up north and people in communities along the way, over from July 19th, I think they left, wasn't it?
I think so.
On my birthday, I think it was July 19th, and they showed up in Regina on Monday night, there was quite a welcome for them at Victoria Park. All these walkers and the people who had joined them along the way, and they had a ceremony and they talked about their walk a little bit. And then on Tuesday, they went to the legislature to talk about it more. And they have petitions that are all over the province. These petitions are out there circulating. And because they don't want, these are the communities that came together to say we do not want nuclear waste stored in our communities. And if you're interested, you can go onto Facebook. There are two different pages. One is titled 7,000 Generations. I think it's 7,000 Generations Against Nuclear Waste, I believe. If you just type in 7,000, you'll probably find it on Facebook. And the other one is Say No to Nuclear Waste Storage in Saskatchewan. And you can get a lot of information there. The other thing is if you're interested in a petition that you maybe would like to circulate in your community, or you have friends, or you'd like to sign a petition, you can actually email me. I have the petition on my email. My email address is MORDENROSE. That's Morden Rose, like Morden, Manitoba. MordenRose@hotmail.com. And I will be happy to send you, email you a petition, the official one that's going to the legislature. They'll be collecting them until the fall when they will be returning here and presenting them to our government, to, because the petition is actually to ask the government to ban nuclear waste storage in Saskatchewan. So, having said that, we will have a show later in the future as an ongoing process to this commitment.
I have an excerpt from the message to the Pine House Walkers from Gordon Edwards, who is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. This is an excerpt from what he wrote to them. Your long march helps to dramatize the enormity of what the nuclear industry is doing to the earth. The materials that would be stored in northern Saskatchewan are the same materials that were spewed across Europe and northern Canada from the Chernobyl reactor disaster more than 20 years ago. They are the same materials that are contaminating beef, tea, land, fish, and people in Japan as a result of the Fukushima disaster.
Right.
And it goes on.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, having said that, let's go on to talk about some more of your flyers, the reasons why it's important that you hand out these flyers. And some, I noticed when you got there on bottled water. I remember I mentioned that when you had that flyer out. I mentioned it on the show because I believe this is so important. I've always been dead set against bottled water, although I do see that there can be some use for sending water places where there is no water in emergency situations. Mm-hmm. But in general, all this bottled water, I find it problematic, all the plastic bottles, all the production of plastic and all that sort mm-hmm. of thing, and the waste. And so go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Right. Well, we began this flyer with a story about grade 7 and 8 students at Sacred Heart Elementary School in Estevan who are our inspiration. They decided they wanted to ban bottled water from their school. When Nestle Waters Canada got wind of the students' decision, they sent a letter of rebuttal to the Estevan Mercury and also offered to fly in a company representative from Toronto to debate the issue with the students.
Wow.
So all the way from Toronto to Estevan. On June the 6th, the students and their teachers hosted Nestle Waters Canada's Director of Corporate Affairs, John Chaloner II.
Ooh.
Holy cow.
Sounds awfully impressive.
His main arguments were that banning bottled water did not reduce the number of plastic bottles in landfills and that bottled water is a necessary right. Presenting the case against bottled water were local members of Development and Peace and Kairos. Although the debate had no declared winner or loser, the students seemed to have stuck to their original decision. The Coca-Cola machine that dispensed bottled water at the school has been removed. So, yay,
wow.
Sacred Heart Elementary School.
Yeah. Yeah.
That brings up an interesting point. How many places do you see public buildings where the public water fountain is not working anymore, or maybe there's a drink machine pushed in front of it that's plugged in and you have to pay money to get a drink?
And one thing my mom said, because she was one of the people who went, is that afterwards they had asked, because they were going to replace the Coke machine, but they were also wondering if there was a way to get juices or healthier things in the community. And I guess this is secondhand source, but from my understanding that they refused, that it was seen as really threatening, that they didn't want to have pop machines in their school, but they wouldn't want to provide alternatives. So just like looking at the corporate investments in things and the reactions when we go for change, I think is something that's really important for us to be aware of. Yeah.
Well, and I'd like to, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are comparisons out there of the cost of having a drink of water out of a public fountain compared to the profits to the corporation that sells bottled water. And I'm sure it's huge, and I'm sure that's why, was it the CEO or somebody from Nestle flew out to talk to a bunch of school children about the fact that they wanted to ban bottled water in their school. Absolutely threatening. Yeah, very interesting. And recently, I believe, and for those of you listeners who want to correct me, feel free to send me an email, I believe that the province of Manitoba has recently banned bottled water
from I think provincial functions.
I think so. I'm not sure the extent of it, but obviously they're on the right track.
Yeah.
Just like they have been in the past with nuclear waste and nuclear waste storage and that sort of thing, nuclear power.
And that's a neat connection with the walk from Pinehouse. One thing that I noticed at the event is there was a big focus on water, and they had water ceremonies, but also they were talking about how the issue of storing waste wasn't just about northern Saskatchewan, it's about all of Saskatchewan, and that this affects all of us. And but also talking about how we were all connected through water.
Through the water table.
And someone recently said Saskatchewan is the meaning of it, swift flowing water.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think
okay.
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, so I just thought that was kind of a neat connection. Yeah.
Yes, they did. They collected water at every stop along the way from the north to the south. Mm-hmm. And I think the mayor of one town brought water from that town, and they added it to their bottle, and they have they had a sacred buffalo horn with them, and they poured the water from Regina into, mixed it in with the rest of the water from the rest of the province, all clean drinking water from the lakes. And this is one of the major issues, is that we are connected by the water table all over the province. Mm. So if there is burial of nuclear waste in the north, in the bedrock, the concern
Canadian
is,
Shield.
Yes, yes, the concern is that if there is an accident and there is leakage, that it will not just affect the people of the north, but it'll affect everywhere that water goes. So I think that was the major focus, and it was about the water. When I was in Pinehouse for their public forum and education system, this is something that Max Morin talked about. Mm-hmm. It's about the water, and it's about the cleanliness of it and how it affects everybody.
Yeah, it seems like that it's an issue that will really unite us.
Right, that whole ecological system,
Now, apparently in the global north, we are not buying as much bottled water as we used to as a result of campaigns against it. Mm. However, in the global south, the bottled water companies are now focusing there, and they're buying up springs and wells and fencing them off so that local people can no longer use those springs and wells. And then they target the middle class market, and then governments say they don't have, since there is bottled water available, governments say that they don't really have to worry about keeping pure water in the public system. So poor people are left with crummy water as a result of what the bottled water companies are doing.
So this has been a great fear for a long time. Yeah. That water would become commodified, and we're seeing it in action, in total action.
Right.
And so seems to be something that's a commonality to any kind of voice against the corporatization of resources in the past, that if we reject that in the north, well, all they do is go to the south. Mm-hmm. They go to the south and they take it there. And it takes a while for people to become educated and to fight against it. And, of course, one of the things that I found interesting was when I went to Pinehouse, I took a young man with me who's been on our show, Bruno Hernani. And Bruno is from Lima, Peru. And Bruno, I took him because the connection, because he's an environmentalist and a sociologist, and it was wonderful for him and the people of the north to meet together. And one of the things that he said was, the people where I come from in the south, at a meeting like this, there would have been violence if someone had tried to come in without identification. You know, this kind of concern about the natural resources and wondering who these strangers are that are coming. It's a different mindset, a totally different mindset. So he was quite interested and pleased at how welcomed everyone was up there in northern Saskatchewan. So, anyway.
That's interesting. Yeah, one of the things I noticed from the walk is in terms of how issues are so related, because when they're talking about which communities are being targeted, obviously racism and poverty and issues of imperialism and colonialism play a role in terms of one of the ways that they were trying to convince the community, from my understanding, about why it would be a good thing to store the waste or take the money is because it would be jobs for youth. Or I also heard someone, just slightly out of conversation, saying someone had mentioned that it would keep youth out of prison. And so I thought that directly related to social issues and how environmental and social issues are not so distanced from each other, which I think a lot of times in my own experience I've seen kind of like a little bit of separation mm-hmm. on the two.
Right.
And so I feel like, yeah, that it just, that whole experience really showed how everything's tied together. And if we're like, as so is someone who, for me, speaking out against prisons, I think it's also mm-hmm. important to be involved in all different aspects right. of things. Right. But just the different, yeah, the connections that
right.
everything's really, really tied together.
Exactly. Florence, how did the vigil go from Regina making peace vigil and anti-war protests to bottled water? How did that happen?
Everything is all connected.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. I mean, with, you know, if we are exploiting other people through water, violence is going to be an outcome.
Absolutely.
And so on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There are places where protests mm-hmm. would be put down by violence, mm-hmm. where there is no peaceful mm-hmm. protest allowed, and we know about that here, mm-hmm. of course. Right. So
the whole idea of peace, too, because I was in the fall, I was in a conflict studies program, and one thing I was thinking about is there's like a superficial sense of peace, or sometimes bringing up something that's been omitted would cause discomfort or cause conflict or cause a little controversy. I almost feel like other people are kind of like this attitude of, no, we have to keep the peace and you don't want to stir things up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but mm-hmm. but that's not peace. Like, that's yeah. not justice. Like, yeah. Yeah. It's deeper. It's deeper. And I don't feel like even, I feel like in communities where there isn't, when the military or like police control is more subtle, mm-hmm. then it's easy to feel like that we are, but we have this sense of right. peace or justice right. going on, right. which is, to me, feels very superficial. Right. Yeah,
Florence, you've got a flyer ready for next Thursday? About Islamophobia.
No, this was last Thursday.
This was last Thursday.
This was right? yesterday's.
Oh, flyer. That's right. Yes, because I sent you
flyer.
An email.
Right.
Yeah, I want to do a show on this in the near future, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. hopefully we'll get, I think we've, mm-hmm. I've got a line on a couple of people that will come in and talk okay. about it. But what kind of stuff did you have in your flyer about Islamophobia? And, I mean, is it really prevalent? Or, I mean, are people really Islamophobic? I feel like... I feel like a well-known radio personality that shall go on nameless who said, do we really have racism in Saskatchewan? I thought that was over.
Right. Shocking.
Yeah, well, just the flyer starts with a definition of Islamophobia. It's hostility towards Islam and Muslims, prejudice against or fear of Islam and Muslims, anti-Muslim racism. Is there much of it? It's everywhere. I mean, I hear it in conversations with, I would, you know, friends of mine who at least consider themselves to be very progressive. Two of the things that seem to push their buttons are, well, I'll start with veils.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
women's
this,
rights and
this,
veils.
And the hullabaloo yeah, over veils. Yeah. I mean, so many non-Muslim Canadians are angry when they see a veiled woman. I mean, they tell me, I want to rip it off. I have heard people
heard
I know
too.
Say, and particularly Canadian women who claim to be feminists. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to be, you know, they seem to be particularly disturbed. So, I mean, I guess some of the questions I would ask when I get that sort of reaction is, are they equally outraged when they see a half-naked white teenager, you know, walking around? I mean, it's not the only interpretation of veiling, but both veiling and half-nakedness can be seen as reactions to patriarchy. One, cover yourself up totally. The other, strip yourself half-naked. I mean,
right.
both.
I think, for me, it's what they're failing to understand as maybe they call themselves feminists, but feminism, for me, is all about choice.
Right. You know, it seems that the veil threatens, you know, our freedom, but freedom to do what? I mean,
right.
wear a bikini or
right.
and not wear a niqab? I mean, right. what is our freedom? And lots of feminists call for a ban on the burqa. But such strict decrees, either way, deny Muslim women their autonomy. I mean, it's, you know, it's a choice, as you said. Right. What is the choice?
Yes.
We had a quote on the flyer from a woman named Arun Hassan, who addresses the question, why would a Muslim woman choose to wear a veil? She says, for identity, for cultural values, for political symbolism, for anti-consumerism, for protection, for countering the hypersexualization of women, or for religious belief. So there's
a lot of reasons.
Yeah, a lot of very good sound reasons. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And for what purpose would I become angry at a woman's choice to dress the way she chooses?
Exactly. I mean, I don't get it.
What other areas do we see that?
Honor crimes is the next one that I hear most.
So blame the religion.
Yeah, stigmatize the religion as if there wasn't violence against women throughout Canadian culture. The figure that I took, according to Statistics Canada, 51% of Canadian women have experienced at least one incident of physical or sexual violence since the age of 16. So violence against women is not just a Muslim problem, it's a serious cross-Canada problem.
Right.
I think that's a good example of, like, scapegoating, because, like, I think in terms of, like, European Western white superiority, that that's kind of one tool or technique is to be, we're fine, we don't have violence against women, but look at them. Mm-hmm. That's, mm-hmm. like, that's it. It takes the spotlight away from being critical of our own culture and saying, that's where the demon is.
Right.
And I think scapegoating happens a lot.
It for me, it's reminiscent of the movies that were made during the rise of the Nazi era and the beginnings of the Holocaust, when the Jews were depicted in movies as other than being human, and that whole scapegoating of a particular race or a particular culture or a particular religion. In order to have superiority and power. And it's happening all over again. It's never gone away, in my opinion. It's never gone away.
Yeah. It's very scary.
So I guess that's how groups get... Because I remember my teacher saying, like, in terms of race, but I guess how groups get racialized. So if it doesn't exist as a race, but how... If you racialize a group, that's part of, like, the process of legitimizing, their... less than human quality.
Right. Yeah. Florence, I noticed you have a flyer that you put out on Canada Day. It says Happy Canada Day.
Happy Canada Day, and it has a little beaver and a Canadian flag and so on the front. Inside, there's a Canada Day quiz.
Oh, no. We have, how much time left, Jim? We might not have enough time.
We've got about 3.5 minutes.
Okay, shoot, Florence, let's go.
All right. What historically, the answers are on the back page.
So. Okay, good. I can't see them from here.
What historically important event took place in Regina on July 1st, 1935?
Was that the Regina riot?
You're right, yes.
Yahoo! I went on a tour of downtown Regina a few years ago, and they took you on a tour of where the rioters went. That was fascinating.
Yes, 2 points to clarify in relation to the Regina riot. It began when the Regina police and the RCMP charged a crowd. It wasn't the crowd that started the riot or the trekkers. And that both a policeman and a trekker were killed. There was denial that a trekker had been killed for many years.
Yeah, there was cover-up on that. I read a good book by Bill Weiser on that.
Yeah.
Okay, next.
What is the longest war Canada has ever been engaged in? This is a multiple-choice question.
Uh-oh.
A, World War I. B, World War II. C, Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
Yeah.
How many years has it been now?
It has been over 10 years. It's now in its 10th year.
At about $1 billion a year.
Yeah. Well, $18.5 billion by the end of 2011.
Close.
Wow. So what else could we use that money for?
Yes, exactly. True or false? Children who attend school on reserves receive 30% less funding for education than other Canadian children.
Absolutely true.
Yes, that is true. How many Canadians, another multiple choice, how many Canadian children live in poverty? A, 50,000 to 100,000, B, 200,000 to 300,000, C, 600,000 to 700,000.
Oh, boy. Those are all big numbers.
I bet just the 600,000 to 700,000.
Yes, it's C, the biggest. In 1989, the House of Commons unanimously resolved to eliminate poverty among Canadian children.
I was going to say, what happened to
by
that?
By the year 2000. Mm. Today, 610,000 children are nearly 1 in 10 are poor. Should I will skip then to the last question. All of the rest of the questions are quite
serious.
Okay,
because we have 1 minute left.
This is a joke question.
Okay.
Now, Jim already knows the answer.
I'll be quiet.
We try occasionally to be humorous. How do you stop strips of Canadian bacon from curling in the frying pan?
Oh, boy.
And the answer is?
Go ahead.
Take away their tiny brooms.
And on that note, we're going to say goodbye to Florence Stratton and Shannon Corkery of the Regina Making Peace Vigil. Pop by and see them on Thursday at lunchtime and find out what they have in their flyers and educate yourself. And if you feel like you got some time, join them and get to know them, because they're incredible people who spend their times trying to make a difference in our world.
It'd be good to have more youth out there, too, so...
It would.
Okay, as we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. To discover how you can contribute to the abolition of human rights violations, visit our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."